What's up, Melanated family? This is your brother Harrison, back for another interview. Thank you for tuning in to the Melanated Convo podcast. On today's show, I have a really special guest, a brother who has written an interesting book that I think everyone in our community needs to just get a grasp of and an understanding of. Today on the show, I have the brother Milton Olamide, who wrote the book Manufacturing Hate: How Africa Was Demonized in Western Media, which I think, again, is a very important topic. The brother is also the owner of Black Star News. To my understanding, he's a professor at John Jay College teaching African studies. So all of these are very interesting things for the community family. So everybody, welcome Milton Olamide to the show today. How are you doing today, brother?
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm honored to be on your show.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming. And like I said, this is definitely an interesting topic that I think we need to get into. And, you know, I try to reach everyone in our community, but specifically people a little younger. So I think it's important for all generations to have an understanding of how the media works and yes. how we're viewed in this country and abroad. That's and, right. you know, I want to make sure that African-Americans and Africans have a clear line of understanding as well. And sometimes that's fractured by the media. So this is an important conversation. So first off, tell me, brother, what got you into being in this country? What got you into teaching African studies?
Okay, very good. What got me into being in this country? So my family was originally from Uganda, but I also grew up in Tanzania. And in Tanzania is when I became really conscious. I started reading a lot when I was around 12 years old. I started reading about other parts of the world, started reading about the politics and history of other parts of the world. I became familiar with the conditions for sisters and brothers in this country. I started reading James Baldwin when I was in Tanzania at 12. But the other thing I did was I went to what's called the U.S. Information Services. So it's part of, how should I say? Well, as a 12-year-old, you wouldn't know, but it's part of the U.S. propaganda machine. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. has embassies all over the world, but then it also had that agency called the U.S. Information Services, where you can go and read all sorts of publications, every newspaper, every magazine, American publications. So I spent a lot of time there. But then I noticed, like, in terms of reference to African people, the representation was always negative, referring to Africans as tribes people, as tribal, as tribesmen. And let me make this distinction. So for example, if an African says, I come from this tribe or that tribe, obviously they don't mean it in a derogative fashion. They want to identify that, for example, if I'm from Nigeria, I might be Igbo. That's the region I hail from. That's the Igbo culture. I might be Yoruba. I might be Hausa. If I come from Uganda, I might be a Muganda, I might be a Acholi, and I would say my tribe is Acholi. But when Europeans use that, they don't mean it to distinguish other Africans from other Africans. They mean it to distinguish Africans from other human beings, particularly from Europeans. So when they say Africans are tribal or tribe, they're basically, it's another way of saying backward or savage, see? So even a 12-year-old, I could see that distinction. But obviously, there's not too much you can do as a kid about that, right? What are you going to do? You don't have enough knowledge or an ability to articulate and push this. But that wasn't the reason, of course, why I came to this country. I fell in love with movies as a young person. And not surprisingly, young people do that, right? So my number one goal was to come to the United States to go to film school. every kid around the world is familiar with Hollywood because of the propaganda machine. Mm-hmm. But since my father was going to pay for it, he said, that's not an option. You know, if you're going to go study, you need to get a real degree. You can't go to film school, not on my dime anyway. So when I got the chance to come to the United States, I went to Syracuse, upstate. Big mistake. Good school, but it's just too cold out there, right? I don't know if you've been upstate.
No. Well, yeah, I've been to New York.
So yeah, it's crazy. But I went there and I studied economics. But my love was really writing. Even as a 12-year-old, I started writing letters to the editor, right? Complaining about these depictions that I didn't like. So when I said I couldn't do much about it, I was wrong. Actually, I couldn't write a book, obviously, at that stage. But that's when I started engaging media. I would write letters to the editor, and that carried on with me even when I came to this country. When I thought African descendants in this country, you know, sisters and brothers were being maligned in the media, I would object and write a letter to the editor. When I felt Africans on the continent were being denigrated, I would complain. When I felt our Haitian sisters and brothers were being maligned. So I found myself engaging with media. Mm-hmm. But there's an incident that really, really, that of course I'm talking about today because I could never forget. And this was over three decades ago now. When I was an undergrad, my freshman year at Syracuse, during the English class, we discussed a book called Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. And many people around the world are familiar with that book. And the professor was talking about it and saying, this is one of the greatest books ever written in the English language. But if you read Conrad, it's just a series of negative racist stereotypes about Africans. And he was reading this with obvious pleasure. And the class, students are impressionable, right? Mm-hmm. So they're agreeing with him. And I'm the only one sitting there in the class feeling very uncomfortable and stressed, but not being intellectually or academically equipped to challenge the professor and said, listen, you're wrong. This is racist information. And this is why you're wrong, and counter it. So I have to sit in silence. But then many years later, when I decided to go back to school, after my undergrad, I worked for a couple of years here in New York City. I went back to the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia to study journalism. And when you're doing the master's in journalism, you get a chance to write a master's thesis. So I said, you know what? This is my opportunity to now address something that's bothered me for such a long time. How was the first representation of African people that Europeans disseminated around the world when they first engaged with Africans? And then how did it transcend to where we are today? So that became the subject of my research. So I first read the works of so-called explorers, you know? These are arrogant Europeans who went to Africa in the 18th century, and they renamed lakes, rivers, mountains, even countries that had African names, indigenous names. And they called them explorers, even though Africans were the ones who showed them where to find these rivers and lakes. They said they discovered it and renamed it. They renamed even a whole country, Rhodesia, which is, of course, today Zimbabwe. So I read their works, and basically what they were doing, because they went there before Africa was officially colonized by the Europeans. So they were setting, they were like the scouts of imperialism. So they did two things primarily. They depicted Africans as savages, as backward, as uncivilized. But at the same time, they were identifying where are the resources located in each region of Africa. And you find this in their book. So even though, so for example, there's one in particular called Samuel Baker, whom I discussed in my book, who wrote his book in 1866 called Albert Nyanza. And he's saying, Africans should not be compared to the noble character of the dog. But at the same time, he's also saying, the immense wealth that is contained on the African continent will benefit and enrich Europeans. So they're making the argument for colonization of Africa, which then came in 1884-85 at the Berlin Conference. And if many people are not familiar with that, anyone is not familiar with that, look that up, Berlin Conference. Berlin, the German city, from November 1884 to February 1885. They said to themselves, basically, you know, because they'd already started fighting amongst themselves, the Europeans, for territory in Africa. So they said, if we're going to plunder, steal a whole continent, let's do it like gentlemen. Let's not fight. Let's sit down and divide it over the table. And that's exactly what they did. So they said they carved out the continent. France, you get this. British, the British, you get this. The Belgians, you get this. Portugal, Spain, Italy, Germany, yeah, you name it. They partitioned the entire continent, except for one country, Ethiopia. Now, when Italy sent a huge imperial army to try to take over Ethiopia, Ethiopia dealt them a decisive defeat. And not enough of that history is taught. And we understand why, because Europeans don't want the world to know that a European country was actually defeated decisively by an African country. And that was at the Battle of Adwa, where the Empress of Ethiopia, Taitu, was fighting alongside the king or emperor, Menelik, defeated an Italian army, killed two generals, captured one general, and the commander-in-chief named General Oreste Baratieri. Before he went to Ethiopia, he had promised the king of Italy. Italy used to be a kingdom. The king's name was Umberto. And he said, I'm going to come back to Italy with the emperor of Ethiopia in a cage so we can display him in the zoo. Instead, he had to run for his life to get away from the battlefield. And that was the Battle of Adwa, March 1, 1896. I want people to know a lot about that. In fact, as I speak, I'm writing a graphic book about that because I know young people like graphic books about the Battle of Adwa. I think that history needs to be well known. So I did all that, but then I did one other thing. I said, now, let me see how the writings of these so-called explorers, how did it shape the writings that came later on in magazines like National Geographic, the New York Times, Time Magazine, and all that stuff. And so I did that research, and then I put my paper together for my master's. It was well received by my peers. I won one of those awards that they give to students at the end of the class at Columbia. And then I was invited by a magazine called Columbia Journalism Review, which is also in the school establishment, because they wanted to publish it. Then they didn't publish it. I was waiting for it to be published. One issue came out, I didn't see it. Another issue came out, I didn't see it. So then I called the managing editor. His name was Michael Hoyt. I said, what's going on with my publication? And then he tells me a decision was made not to publish. And I said, why? He said, well, two editors supported, two opposed, and the top editor, executive editor, cast the negative vote. I said, and what was the reason? He said, oh, there was a feeling these things happened a long time ago. I said, how are you going to write history without going back into history? They said, oh, you know what? Let me have my paper. And then he said something that really caught my attention. He said, why do you want it back? It's not the same as what you gave us. I said, that's precisely why I want it back. And I went back and I got my paper. And there's a part in the paper in the beginning that they wrote on my behalf without my knowledge when they were still considering publishing. They said, the following excerpts from the New York Times archives and interviews with New York Times former reporters and present reporters is not an indictment of the New York Times, which in the past has written insightful articles about Africa. This is just to show how any media organization can go astray. So then I realized, wait, these guys are afraid of the New York Times. So I sent a copy of the paper to the New York Times. They acknowledged that, yes, you discovered a lot of ugly stuff from our past. And then I sent it to other publications, and none of them would publish it. And to cut the long story shorter, it took me 30 years before I could find a publisher for this book. manufacturing hate.
Wow.
How Africa was demonized in Western media. It just came out in June 2021. Now, let me give you one final point. In December 2020, the New York Times did an article about the Kansas City Star. The Kansas City Star had apologized for its past racist coverage and depiction of African sisters and brothers in Kansas, right? So they apologized and said, this is what we're going to do now going forward. The New York Times did a story about that. So when my book came out, I sent it to the publisher of the New York Times and I said, listen, you guys did an article about Kansas City Star owning up to its past. But what about your own past that I discovered, that I let you know about when I first discovered it like 30 years ago? And now I have it in the form of a book. Here's a copy of the book. And I think you should do the right thing and also apologize. That was in September 2021. I've yet to get an acknowledgement that he got the book. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he's a slow reader and maybe he'll get to it. So that's definitely where we are today.
definitely. Great. That's wow. Interesting story. 30 years, huh? So you didn't give up. So let me ask you a question. You
And that's one other lesson. Please, I urge sisters and brothers, when you're onto a good thing, a right thing, and you know the facts on your side, don't ever give up. Obviously, you're not going to stop doing everything else, right? Correct. I continued working. I continued gaining knowledge. I teach at John Jay. Now I teach African history. And I also, in fact, beginning last semester, started teaching at Columbia, teaching journalism. But going back to your point, never give up when you think justice is on the on your side.
And that's what that's one of the things I was going to ask before we get into some, you know, before we get into some other questions. How did you endure that amount of time? Because that's 30 years. So I'm sure at some point in time you say, well, you know what? Maybe this isn't going to work out. Maybe I should, you know, put the book out myself or just put it as an article, just write several articles or something.
Okay, very good.
What made you stick to this book format opposed to releasing this information in other ways, you know?
Right. Okay, very good question. Actually, in fact, I did. I wrote many articles about it. And then I wrote articles about it and I started getting invited to speak to colleges, including students at Columbia University invited me to speak as well. And I kept getting asked, why don't you put it out as a book? And in fact, I did put it out as a self-published book many years ago. And I knew I was onto the right thing when I printed 5,000 copies and sold every copy very quickly. I would go to events, for example, if there are 100 people and I have 100 books, I would sell every copy. Because once I read the excerpts from the material and I give the history, people just can't believe it. But people want that knowledge. I've never gone to an event with a copy of the book and come back with copies of the book. There's always never enough when I go to events. But, you know, when you self-publish it, it is impossible to get it reviewed. Newspapers typically don't review self-published books. You can't get it in schools. It's very difficult, almost impossible if it's self-published, or to get in the library. I did manage to get in a few libraries because I think the quality and the information was there.
But and Milton, you're saying the review, tell me, like, and this is something I've kind of wanted to know for a while. How does the review affect the outcome of the book? Like, how
it affects the sales. It does, because how would people know about the book unless it's reviewed? You know, even a negative review would at least let people know about the book. So it's very difficult to get it reviewed in a newspaper or a magazine, or to get invited to speak in a radio interview or a television interview about a self-published book, because it's referred to as vanity. This is somebody just liking it themselves, right? So they're publishing it, but doesn't necessarily meet the standards that most books should meet. That's the perception. I'm not saying, you know, that is how it the reality is. So that's why I kept sending it to publishers and I kept improving the research. And finally, I got a publisher about a year and a half ago, and it came out in June. And this, it was, when I self-published it, it was a different title. And I must say, actually, I've enhanced the current edition. I have more chapters. I think it's much more refined with more research and more up-to-date as well. So when I self-published it, it was called The Hearts of Darkness, How White Writers Created the Racist Image of Africa. Very straightforward. So this title is the title that the publisher was also comfortable with, and I felt it still conveyed the same exact information, and I was also comfortable with it, Manufacturing Hate, because that's exactly what it was. And we can go into the detail of why I selected this title as well later on. But yeah, that's why it took such a long time. Because, and I'll be honest with you, most writers are afraid, in the corporate world anyway, corporate media, are afraid of the New York Times. Because many of them want to be either mentioned in the New York Times, or they want to write for the New York Times, or they want to work for the New York Times. And this affects the publishing world as well. So somebody who publishes you, they feel they could be seen by the New York Times as attacking the New York Times, which is completely preposterous, you know? So you're saying you're censoring yourself because you're afraid of the New York Times, because that's what Columbia Journalism Review had done when they wrote that introduction saying this is not an indictment of the New York Times on my behalf. So I suppose at one point they might have told me that, listen, this is our compromise. I don't know, but at the end of the day, they never publish it because they're afraid of the New York Times. And that is completely preposterous. We should not accept that.
Interesting. Now, something else I wanted to ask you. Now, tell me from your understanding, right? Because you have written a book about how the media demonizes Africa, but we understand the media in general, you know, kind of treats African Americans in a particular way as well. So
of course,
from your understanding, Milton, like, what do you think is their benefit? What's the benefit for them creating a system that makes us look a particular way when we know it's not true? When any research, you spend any time researching, you're gonna know it's not true. Why do you think that's the thing that they do?
Okay, very good. There are many reasons, but the primary reason is historically. And this is, we can go way back to the era of slavery. And then what followed slavery was colonialism. And then what we have today is neo-colonialism, which is still colonialism in a different, in a new form. And colonialism was slavery in a new form. So when you have a situation where you have millions of human beings being kidnapped from Africa and brought to the so-called New World, whether in the United States, whether in the Caribbean or South America, how do you justify treating other human beings as animals? So even Europeans would ask that question, why are we doing this to fellow human beings? So it was critically important to shape their mind to understand that these may look like human beings, but they're not quite on our level. They're closer to animals. And if we can allow animals to be abused, we should also not be too uncomfortable abusing Africans. So that was the logic. So that's why the media would heap all this abuses on Africans, or later on African descendants. The nose is a particular way, when the standard should be the thin nose. So the broad nose must be an aberration. That is further proof that they're not quite on our level as human beings. The thick lips, the shape of the skull, and all the other stereotypical manifestations that you see historically through literature and you see even today. And most importantly, of course, the skin, the quote unquote black skin, that is the ultimate aberration. In fact, I have a chapter that I deal with that, where if you go back all the way to Herodotus, writing centuries ago, saying that, in fact, the skin of Africans was black because the semen that the men ejaculate was also black, and that accounted for the blackness of skin. So they're very intrigued by all this, when in fact, it is the other way around. Original human beings were all Africans.
Definitely.
Because they needed melanin to deal with the climatic conditions on the continent. Mm-hmm. And nobody today still argues that human beings did not originate in Africa. That is not agreed, you know, by all sane people anyway. Mm-hmm. And a specific region in Africa, East Central Africa, in the great Rift Valley, the Nile Valley of Africa. That's where humans originated. They were all Africans. And in fact, had they not migrated to other parts of the world about 100,000 years ago, all human beings today would be African. And so the question is, what happened after they migrated to other parts of the world? Over tens of thousands of years, through the environmental and climatic condition, they adapted, their features adapted to adapt to those climatic conditions in Asia, in Europe, in the Americas. And that's how they took on those different features, including the pigmentation. So they had it upside down, you know, treating Africans as an aberration, when in fact it's the complete opposite. The variations came much, much later. You see?
Now, something else I wanted to ask you really quickly while it was on my mind. So how do you think the media's portrayal of us as African people and African American people, how do you think that relates to how the world treats us? Like, how do you think that relates to how the common citizen in the United States may look at me a particular way because of the media? Do you think that's a direct correlation? And how does that affect how we treat each other? Because you just mentioned how they put us on a lower standard to a degree. And in my opinion, if you're not comfortable, you may begin to see yourself the same way the dominant society sees you.
Okay, so you asked me the reasons, and my response, I said there are many reasons, and I had only given you one of the many reasons why they do that. And I said the primary reason was to justify, you know, enslaving human beings, right? And then colonizing, plundering resources from Africa. And then Europeans will say, well, they're not quite human beings like us. And then even today, the abuses that continue. Then the second reason, of course, is precisely what you said. So that others see us in a negative light as well. So if you go to Asia and you see the different ways in which Asians view Africans compared to Europeans, then of course it's not surprising that they also hold Africans at a lower level, intellectually, morally, physically, you know, you have it, right? You go to South America, any other part of the world, the African, and of course, by extension, African descendants, you know, we're all Africans. In fact, we're all Africans, including Europeans, all Africans too, you know. But that is the other reason. And then what you just said, how we view ourselves. And for anybody listening who's not heard this 6-minute interview by Malcolm X, I would recommend they go to YouTube and listen to the 6-minute Malcolm is speaking. And it's called, if you search under, you can't hate the roots of a tree without hating the tree. And what is Malcolm saying? Malcolm is saying, when the Europeans controlled the African continent during colonialism, they portrayed Africa as nothing positive, only negative. Jungles, cannibals, which doctors? And he said, quite naturally, you and I wanted nothing to do with Africa, let alone be associated with Africa or called an African. We started rejecting the color of our skins, the shape of our nose, the shape of our lips, the coarseness of our hair. We wanted those long, fine, dog-like noses, as Malcolm said. And he said, but deep down in his mind, the African descendant in this country is actually very proud of his African heritage and culture and is connected to it. Just doesn't know it, just has to be educated about it. He said, and that accounted for the success of what was then called the Black Muslims in this country, now called the Nation of Islam. He said, they grew very quickly because they were teaching them the African history, the African culture, the African heritage. And once they connected with that, they had the sense of pride and self-confidence, and the organization kept growing. So I strongly recommend that. So the self-hatred is not surprising because it's internalized from a young age when you are consistently taught that white is superior to black. You know, it takes a different level of capability not to submit to that kind of propaganda. So you need to have parents or teachers or associates or elder figures who give you the right instruction to counter this pervasive propaganda, which is a global propaganda. So if you go to Africa, for example, today, let me give you just a couple of examples. We are in 2022. We still have a lake called Lake Victoria in East Africa. The great large body of water is called Lake Victoria. When in fact, Victoria was, of course, the British Queen. When in fact, the lake had African names before the Europeans came. Mm-hmm. Now, African countries, most of them won their paper independence. And I call it paper independence because while they kicked out the Europeans still dominate the continent because the Europeans control the economy. And that's a whole issue for another discussion. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we can have in the future. But the point is, now you have African presidents and prime ministers. Would you not think that the first thing they should do would be to restore the original African names to Lake Victoria? Or you have Victoria Falls, which is between Zambia and Zimbabwe, that beautiful, spectacular waterfall. And if anybody who's not familiar with it, just go on YouTube or Google Victoria Falls and take a look at it. Why? Why do they not have African names up today? Think about that. So we need also to have a mental decolonization before you can have a proper physical decolonization. Let me give you one other example, which to me is quite repulsive, actually. So I spoke earlier about Samuel Baker, the so-called explorer, who said Africans should not be compared to the noble character of the dog. Now, in Uganda, my birth country, there's a school named after him called Sir Samuel Baker Secondary School. But it gets worse. A couple of years ago, I'm reading a newspaper article in one of the newspapers in Uganda. And I'm reading it from here in the US online. It said the alumni, the graduates from that school, had started a fundraising campaign, a successful fundraising campaign, raised a lot of money to build a statue, which they actually built to honor Samuel Baker. Now think about this. Africans in an independent African country, instead of raising money for scholarships for Ugandans to go to school, are raising money to build a statue to honor somebody who said they should not be compared to the noble cat or the dog. It shows a big intellectual disconnection. And this goes back to white worshiping, European worshiping, where white is right.
Mm-hmm.
Not only for whites, but to many black people too, unfortunately.
That's true. Now, what do you think, Milton? Do you think how big of a part in that process when it comes to us thinking white is right and us almost bowing down to some of that structure? Even you'll see black people who will fight each other before they'll go up against some form of white authority figure. So
absolutely.
How big of a part do you think religion has had to do with that?
Okay, very good. I'm glad you asked that question. Because first of all, there's a distortion that Christianity was some sort of a European religion. It's completely not true. But to answer the first part of your question, religion has played a very significant part. Because by the time Europeans came back to Africa to colonize in the 19th century, which is very recent in historical times, they had commercialized their religion, Christianity. So they came with the Bible, the cross, and they said, you Africans, you're practicing. You're paying homage to all these fetishes. You know, these aren't, you know, real gods. To submit to our Christian God, they got Africans to abandon their spirituality, their culture, their names. So they really emasculated Africans, whether it was the religion of Christianity or whether it was Islam, right? But many people are not familiar that all the great religions of the world, including Christianity and Islam, owe their origin to Africa. In ancient Egypt, Kemet, aka Egypt, which is, of course, an African culture, an African civilization. And they pretty much developed the essence of most of the knowledge that we have today, including spiritual practices. And a very good book that I highly recommend for somebody who wants to start learning more about this history is African Origin or Civilization by the late Professor Anta Diop, a great Senegalese scientist. Anta is A-N-T-A, and the last name is spelled D-I-O-P. If you have only enough money to buy one book at this time, I would suggest you spend your money on that book. Because once you learn that history, then it is very difficult for you to be shaken from your foundation and your confidence. How can the people who are the first human beings in the world be inferior to anybody in the world? That just doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. It's not possible. The people that built the structures that we still see in Egypt today. And also, I would like people that are not familiar with the first emperor of a unified Egypt. We are talking about 3,500 or so before the Christian era, the emperor Menes. Also look up, you can easily Google this and look at the image. Look at the image and you'll see the bust of what people like to signify as quote unquote a typical African features. And I don't call it typical African feature, I just call it human features. Mm-hmm. Because after all, those were the original humans. Mm-hmm. And that should end any debate that the original Egyptians were, whether they were Africans or not. Of course, if human beings originated in Africa, of course they were African. And then that's the one part. The second part, which is also something great that Professor Anta Diop did, because Diop was highly educated. Not only was he a historian, a linguist, he was a chemist, he was a physicist, he was a mathematician, he was an anthropologist. So he taught himself because he knew that if you are to challenge the established narrative, the European Academy, you must be better equipped than they are. So this Senegalese goes and he studies in France, and he writes his PhD, right? And he's saying that the original people of Kemet were African, and they refused to give him his PhD. So he goes back and he continues his studying. And that also is the kind of story that inspires me. That's why I had no right to abandon the research that I was doing. So he goes back and comes back 10 years later and defends his PhD again. And the Europeans who didn't want to give it to him were overwhelmed by the knowledge, the facts that he had. They had no choice but to give him his PhD. And this is what he did. Because he built a laboratory at the university in Senegal where he could do carbon dating, carbon radiation dating. And he could also test the level of melanin content in the mummies from ancient Egypt. And he found the melanin level to be consistent with the melanin level of Africans. So he's able to prove that the ancient Egyptians were African. These were from the mummies of ordinary people. And then he asked the folks that controlled the antiquities in Egypt to give him samples from the mummies of the royal family, royal Egyptians, because he wanted to prove that they too were African. And in his lifetime, they refused, and up to today, they still will not provide samples from the tissue of remains from those mummies so that a carbon testing can be done to show that the melanin level is consistent with those of Africans. But at least this is one thing that happened after he joined the ancestors, Anta Djok.
Definitely.
Everything that he argued has now been confirmed. And nobody, as I said, that is a serious person still argues that human beings did not originate in the Nile Valley in Africa, which was the essence of the argument that he made. So I say all this to come back to your point. I say, if we had this knowledge, then our young people and our people generally, African people, African descendants, would not be subjected to this sense of inferiority complex that is intentionally instilled. And let me give you one final observation to address the same question that you posed. The purpose of doing this is to keep non-Europeans divided, to keep African people divided. So look, you have an African continent with a population of 1.3 billion people. You have 54 countries, meaning you have 54 separate governments. Is it surprising that the African continent has some of the world's most impoverished people on the one hand and has all of the world's resources at the same time? Think about that. China, in 1960, the per capita income of China was $90, 89 to be precise, according to World Bank stats. The per capita income of Ghana was about $280. Think about that. 1960, that's not a long time ago. Today, China is a superpower. Is that not correct?
No, you're right. You're right, definitely.
Look at where Ghana is. And Ghana is one of the African countries that actually is doing very well. So I say this to make this point. If we had a United States of Africa, then the African continent would be a global power and would be wealthier than even China. Because even China, that has now caught up to many of the Western countries, is using Africa's resources to build its wealth. So if we had a United States of Africa, any country coming to Africa wanting resources, they would pay the price that African countries want to sell those resources for.
Okay, I get what you're saying.
Because they come and they buy at any price they want.
I got it. Because you're saying there's 54 countries in Africa, but everyone's operating individually.
Exactly. And that's how the Europeans would prefer it. Because then you can go there and get the uranium literally for free. France would not be the power it is today without uranium from countries like Niger in Africa, right? Because France relies on nuclear energy for its energy consumption, including electricity. 75% of that comes from nuclear power. And you don't have nuclear power without uranium. And France does not have uranium, has to go to a country like Niger. So you ask yourself, why is it that Niger is one of the so-called poorest countries in the world, and France is one of the wealthiest countries in the world? How is it possible? How is it possible that the country that has the resources that is making France wealthy is not also wealthy at the same time? The answer is quite simple. It means they're literally stealing the uranium. Otherwise, it would make sense, logically, that Niger should also be wealthy if the beneficiary of its resources is wealthy. And this is the importance of the propaganda demonizing African people so that African people start thinking that, in fact, they are indeed inferior compared to Europeans. And then Africans don't want to associate with other Africans. Africans don't want to associate with African descendants in this country, African Americans. African Americans don't want to associate, you know, within the African American community, because to them, I want to get to where the goods are. And the goods are manifest in being European.
White society and white society. Now, what do you think it's going to take? Because me and you are on the same page that getting a clear understanding of history, at least for me, that has helped me clearly put things in perspective that I look at in this country and really put me in a position mentally where not only I want to see things clearly, but I want to help out. Yes. So what do you think it's going to take to get, because you're speaking about things that have been going on for a really long time. So what do you think it's going to take for us as a people, African and African Americans? What do you think it's going to take for us as a people to come to an understanding that some form of unifying on our own, like without any outside interference, some form of unifying may be the only way to free us from like the colonialism and all the frankly, the white supremacy that we have to deal with in this country and abroad.
It will take the kind of conversation that we're having right now. It will take the knowledge, you know, look at how knowledge can transform individuals. I'll look at individual first, and then I'll look at society. So when I discuss individual, look at Malcolm X. I don't think there's a better story than the transformation of Malcolm Little to Malcolm X. You know, here is a person who did not have formal education in the terms of college education, but taught himself. Because now he had the natural intelligence, of course, but he had been learning the wrong things, right? Because he was subjected to the same kind of propaganda that many young people are subjected to into this country. That his universe was that, what is the best I can do? Be a low-time criminal, be a hustler, be a pimp. That was his universe. But once he started absorbing that knowledge and got to know himself, and the history from where he comes from, he realized the possibilities ahead of him. At the end of his life, he was addressing, one of the last universities he addressed was Oxford University in the United Kingdom, one of the top universities in the world. He addressed Harvard University. All the major universities wanted to hear from him because he had an understanding of history, understanding of politics, understanding from where he came from and the possibilities going ahead. So that is the transformation of one individual based on knowledge. And for people that have not heard the Oxford Union debate, I also recommend go to YouTube and search for Malcolm X Oxford Union debate and just listen to his articulation. And he also knew the power of the media. I gave you an example earlier when he spoke about you can't hate the roots of a tree without hating the tree. Mm-hmm. But at the Oxford Union debate, he's also talking about how Africa is being demonized in the media. And he was talking about the crisis in the Congo in 1960, when the rightful Pan-African elected prime minister, Patrice Lumumba, was murdered by the West. And they installed a puppet in Mobutu and Moise Tshombe, who were taking care of the interest of the multinational corporations. They killed Mobutu. And Malcolm is talking about that. And he's saying how the media glorified people like Tshombe, who was installed to replace Patrice Lumumba, and how they demonized Lumumba at the same time. He knew the power. So that's an individual. Now, look at how knowledge can transform a country. Tiny country called Burkina Faso, used to be called Upper Volta. And then in 1983, he had this young military officer who was very conscious, who came into power and changed the name of the country. So that's the first thing I'm going to do. Upper Volta. That's some name given to the French when they were the colonial rulers. What does it even mean? From now on, we are called Burkina Faso, meaning the land of the upright people. He said, why are we so dependent on the Europeans for everything? He said, when somebody asked me, give me an example of imperialism, I would tell them, look at your plate. And if the food you're eating is imported, that is imperialism. He said, how can you say you're independent if you don't even grow your own food? And he said, before Europeans came, who was feeding us? We were growing our food. We were producing everything we needed. Within 3 years, Burkina Faso was self-sufficient in food. 3 years. Because this one individual opened the mind of his people. He said, why are we importing all these European clothes? We've been manufacturing our own clothes for centuries. We have our farmers who produce our cotton. We have our tailors. We have our weavers who know how to produce textile. Within a few years, he had produced an industry which had been wiped out because they were depending on importing clothes. Now they're growing cotton. Now they're weaving. Now they're tailoring, created a multi-million dollar industry.
Now tell me his name again. Tell me his name again.
Thomas Sankara. S-A-N-K-A-R-A. And there's a brilliant documentary that I suggest people watch. I think it's available on YouTube. It's called Thomas Sankara, the Upright Man. And Thomas, of course, spelled the regular way, T-H-O-M-A-S. And he said, why are we allowing our country to be eaten up by the forest, by the desert? Desertification keeps creeping every year. Very soon, we won't have any green land left. We can stop this. Let's build trees. We're talking 1980s, an African leader, young leader, only in his 30s, talking about the environment and what people can actually do. In the 1980s, when we have today in 2022, we have some Europeans in this country that are still questioning whether global climate change is real. They built 10 million trees and they countered desertification. He taught them to have pride in themselves, number one. And he taught them to realize that they didn't have to be dependent on anybody. Okay, now, what happened to both of these examples that I gave you? Malcolm was assassinated, regardless of who pulled the trigger. Malcolm was killed because he had realized the power of self-sufficiency of African people and the connections. Malcolm went to the Organization of African Unity meeting in 1964 in Egypt, and he started meeting with African leaders, met Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana, he met Milton Obote of Uganda, he met Jomo Kenyatta of Kenya, he met Julius Nyerere of Tanzania, he met Sekou Toure of Guinea, met all these leaders, and he's trying to get their support to do what? To take the issue of Black discrimination, abuse, exploitation in this country before the United Nations. Because he said, as he famously put it, he said, if you take your issue to Uncle Sam, how do you expect that he's going to rule on it? So that's why we need to elevate it beyond civil rights to human rights. And once we have the whole world talking about it, it's going to put a lot of pressure on the U.S. government. So when Malcolm was traveling to African countries, meeting all these leaders, every place he went, there would always be somebody following him, either from the FBI or CIA, or even the U.S. ambassadors in those countries would be talking negatively about Malcolm in whichever African country mm-hmm. he visited, because they knew what impact this would really have if we wow. had a stronger comradeship between Africans on the continent and sisters and brothers in this country. Malcolm was killed. Thomas Sankara, he lived for 3 years ruling the country. By the fourth year, they killed him, and he predicted wow. his death. He went wow. to the same organization, African Unity meeting, because it's an annual meeting. Hmm. So Malcolm went in 64. Thomas Sankara went in 87, in June. He said, listen, and also, once again, and YouTube is a great resource. Social media is a great resource. We have to use it in a positive way. Mm-hmm. And I bring this up because I want people to go to YouTube once again and look at Thomas Sankara speech at Organization of African Unity meeting. And this is what he said. He said, first of all, everything you see me wearing, we produce in Burkina Faso. We don't import. Because to me, it's important that we consume what we produce, and we produce what we consume. Number two, we will not be able to develop our countries so long as we have this huge foreign debt holding us back. And some of this debt were inherited. So check this out. When African countries became independent, right, they inherited the debt that the Europeans who were governing the country had incurred. Hmm. So since you're now the new rulers, okay, well, by the way, when we were running the country, this is all the debt that we took. So now you have to assume it and continue paying. So he said some of the debt we inherited, some of the debt they gave to African leaders whom they knew were corrupt. Why should we allow that to hold us back? That's preventing us from developing our people. So what we need to do is demand that all this debt be canceled, abolish. But if I go alone as Thomas Sankara, individually, I will not be alive to attend next year's Organization of African Unity meeting, right? This was in July, 1987. He said, but they cannot assassinate 54 African presidents. Very difficult. And he's right.
Great point. So if everyone would have stuck together.
Exactly. He said, we need to go with one voice and demand that they eliminate this debt, and all of us will benefit. And if you watch the video of that speech, you'll see all the African leaders nodding and agreeing with him.
Oh, interesting.
But none of them stepped forward. They just nodded their agreement, and that was it. 3 months later, Thomas Sankara was killed.
And it seems like, Milton, just when it comes to Black power, when it comes to African people who are in charge, African Americans and Africa, it seems like Western powers have done a great job of creating fear. Like we, in our minds at this point, we think if I'm going to be the leader and step out on a limb, I'm going to die almost, or I'm going to be injured. Or so it seems like a lot of our brothers and sisters just say, look, man, I want to get along. I want to go along to get along. I don't want to ruffle no feathers. I don't want to die. Now, sometimes it's not death today. Sometimes it's financial castration or being removed from positions of power. But it still seems like that fear has been embedded in us.
Right. Listen, you're right. And as you said, it's not only the physical elimination. Mm-hmm. And the physical elimination, we have many examples. Look at a young person like Fred Hampton. Think about that. Mm-hmm. Look at what happened to most of the Panthers. In fact, Sekou Toure, Kwame Toure, a.k.a. Stokely Carmichael, used to like saying that he only lived because he left the country. And he's 100% right. He moved to Guinea. He used to visit the U.S. and then go back to his adopted country. you know, Guinea. You know, look at Malcolm. There's endless examples. Look at even Dr. King, right? Who was seen as much more, the establishment was much more comfortable with him.
Yep.
But then once he started talking in a political economy critique, you know, a couple of days ago, we were celebrating his legacy. If you notice, most of the corporate media kept talking about that "I have a dream" speech.
All the time.
Forget that speech.
All the time.
The real Dr. King at the end of his life was the Dr. King who spoke at the Riverside Church about why I'm opposed to the Vietnam War. If anybody has not yet heard that speech, please do. Or his last speech, the mountaintop speech, when he's talking about economic boycott, people that discriminate against us. Why should we be giving them our dollars? That was the Dr. King at the end of his life. He had converged with the vision that Malcolm had. So yes, they get rid of you, whether it's in this country, whether it's on the African continent, they get rid of you. And that's why it's important for this knowledge to become pervasive. We can't have this one person speaking this truth to power. We must have, as Sankara said, if it's in Africa, have all the 54 leaders speaking the same language.
Yeah, and I think if we're talking America, there needs to be some form of the same, because in my opinion, Milton, we have different classes of Black people. So we'll have like an entertainer class. We'll have a class of Black folks who are intellectual. We'll have just the everyday people. And sometimes we see each other as different when in actuality, we're all together. If we all figured out a way to come together, you know, we would be much further off than we are now. And like we've both said, there has been examples of this taking place. So I really appreciate you sitting in with me today, brother. Now, also, one last question.
Yes.
Because I know you have the website as well, right?
Blackstarnews.com, right?
Yes, Blackstar News. So tell everybody, how does a Black person in this country, if I want to consume media, but I don't want to be fooled, like I don't want to be lied to, I want to get clear perspectives. How does a younger person approach perceiving media and getting all this this information without being jaded, or without getting fed too much propaganda, without knowing exactly what it is, you know?
Yeah, it's difficult because there's so much bombardment out there, right? With all this information, with all this misinformation, you know, it's critical to have a concrete knowledge of the history and where you really want to go, because you can't really know where you want to go without knowing where you've been. Because once you know where you've been, you understand where you are today.
Definitely.
So the history is critical, without a doubt. In fact, and, you know, this may sound like it's in a roundabout way, but I think it's still answering your question anyway. I teach at John Jay, right? African history. By the end of the semester, my students are not the same people. They walk out with a different level of consciousness. They learn about ancient Kemet, Egypt. They learn about the origins of human beings. I'm shocked that college students could be asking me, really? Human beings originated in Africa? Think about that. They learn about Patrice Lumumba, Kwame Nkrumah, Thomas Sankara, Julius Nyerere, Steve Biko, Mandela, Winnie Mandela. They learn about all these individuals, and then they're able to put themselves and their own experience and existence in proper context. Their confidence level is elevated. And many of them come back and they tell me that after our discussions in the class, they go back and share the discussion with their parents or their siblings. When we're teaching online because of the pandemic, many of them, at the end of the semester, we have like a debriefing where we have a discussion. Everybody gets to say what was the experience taking this class. Several of them revealed to me for the first time that even though I could only see their image on screen, and sometimes they turn off the image, the whole family would be sitting there listening to the discussion.
Interesting.
Which shows the yearning for the correct knowledge is there. And we need to teach them that, because they have this, the talent, the skills. Young people are very savvy when it comes to this new technology. Now, if you combine that savviness with some instruction, basic instruction in the history, there's nothing that can stop them. And one final point, I'm actually working on a book now called African History for Americans. Hmm. Initially, it was going to be African History for high school. But then I realized, wait a minute, if they're going back and teaching their parents as well, so then it should be for everybody. And that's why it's called African History.
Definitely, definitely, definitely. Well, thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much, brother, for joining us today. It was a beautiful discussion. I knew you would have some pertinent information for us. Now, tell everybody, Milton, if they wanted to buy that book, how can they go about doing that?
Very good. If you want to buy the book, Manufacturing Hate, How Africa Was Demonized in Western Media, there are two ways. You can go to Amazon. But I have to say, and Amazon is the price I notice is, I think it's almost $20 more than if you went to the publisher directly. Hmm. If you went to the publisher directly, you would get it within a few days, I believe 3-4 days. So the best place I would suggest, go to the publisher. The publisher is Kendall Hunt Publishing Company, KendallHunt.
Kendall Hunt Publishing.
KendallHunt.com. So it would be KendallHunt.com. It's the website. Or if you just put the title on Google, you'll see the URL of the publishing company will pop up and just click on the publishing company.
Got it. Got it. Well, thank you very much, brother, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
If they wanted to reach out to you, do you have social media?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. You can follow me at Ali Madi on Twitter. That's A-L-L-I-M-A-D, like David I. So it's at Ali Madi. But also feel free to reach out to me, 646-261-7566 or malimadi@gmail.com. That's malimadi@gmail.com.
Definitely, definitely. Well, we enjoy having a brother on today. These type of conversations are so necessary in our community. We spend our time in a lot of different ways, enjoying entertainment, laughing, like you section off how you want to spend your time, and that's fine. But it's also important sometimes that you take the necessary time to learn about history. Take the necessary time to learn about where you come from. Learn about the people, the places, and the things that have shaped our history. That'll give you a better perspective on what you're actually looking at today. So I appreciate the brother Milton Alamadi for coming on the show today, talking about his book. Everybody go out and get that book. This has been another episode of the Melanated Convo Podcast. Don't forget to like this show, share this show. If you listen to it on Facebook, on the YouTube channel, continue to subscribe to the YouTube channel as well. This has been another great conversation, y'all. We out.
Thank you.